Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count for your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
And I thought, at 20, if I can get to that point, then everything will be great. And of course, everything was not great because I was poor. None of this was paying me a dime. And I would be given a round trip ticket to another country in a hotel room. And I would go home and have to do everything I could not to spend money. So then, you know, part of that is saying, I always assumed if I got to that accomplishment, then my life would be so easy. But perhaps for some people, they get to that accomplishment and they think, this is really all I ever needed. I can focus my energies elsewhere right now. It's much more valuable for me to always say, well, now I would like to do this. Now I would like to try this.
That was Alex Ross Perry. I'm Sam Fragoso, and this is Talk Easy. Welcome to the show. Hey everyone, before we get going on Alex here, I want to shout out two individuals who helped make Talk Easy happen this week. It's Jim Hosking and Dustin Andries. In case you missed last week's episode with Bill Pullman, we have now set up a place for you to donate to the show. We are a listener-supported, independently operated program, and so every dollar that you can send, big or small, whether it's $2 a month, $10 a month, or just a one-time contribution of any amount, it really does help us continue making this show. To learn more about where and how you can donate, you can visit our website at www.talkeasypod/donate. We're on PayPal at talkeasypod@gmail.com and Venmo at talkeasypod. As we enter the third year of this podcast, I'd like to try to give a little bit to the small group of people that make this show possible each week. And so your contributions are really the best way for us to do that. And so anyone who's donating, I want to say thank you truly for helping make this show possible. Every dollar you send to Talk Easy, to me, is really you putting money towards a thing you like, a kind of conversation that you want to hear more of in the world. And that's how we continue making it possible is with you. So thank you to Jim Hosking and Dustin Andries and a couple other people who did not want me to say their name on the air. I really appreciate it. Moving on. This week on the show is Alex Ross Perry. He is a New York born and bred filmmaker. He's made films such as Golden Exits, Queen of Earth, Listen Up Philip, The Color Wheel, Impelex. He is really a staple within the independent film community and someone I've known for a few years. I think we've done as many interviews as he's made films at this point. And over the years of talking together, I think a really wonderful thing happens when you've interviewed someone so much, which is you have this existing relationship on the page and then off microphone or off the page, whatever it is. And ultimately, the two are deeply interwoven. And so it was a real joy to talk to him for his latest movie. It is called Her Smell. It stars Elizabeth Moss as a 90s punk rock superstar whose best days are probably behind her. It is a chaotic, unnerving, deeply unsettling opus of his. And here's a bit from the trailer.
He was Becky something. Flirt with death. I look ill, but I don't care about it. Becky something. She's a woman. She's a user. A mother. She's a deadbeat. A person. A persona.
I think Her Smell is really a step forward for Alex in a lot of ways. For years, he has made these movies that Don DeLillo called Around the House and In the Yard Fiction, which I think is the same space that Alex likes to operate within. Her Smell is somehow Around the House and In the Yard, but also larger and more expansive than anything he's done. It has the intimacy of his past films while still having a largeness about it. Since I don't think we end up talking about the cast, I want to list a few people in the movie who are excellent. Cara Delevingne, Dan Stevens, Amber Heard, Ashley Benson, Virginia Madsen, Eric Stoltz, Lindsay Burge, and there's even more that I'm forgetting. But everyone here, especially the DP, Sean Price Williams, and the score by Keegan DeWitt, and even the editing by Robert Green, everyone is at the top of their game here. And it is a film absolutely worth seeing in theaters. It is an hour and 35 minutes. That's usually longer than most running time should be, but Alex has made something deserving of that time, and it's really, really special. It's in theaters in New York, April 12th. It will expand to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth on April 19th, and if you are in those cities and can go see it, please go see it. That is the only way for this kind of small, independent film to continue receiving expansion across the country. So go out and support independent cinema. And now, without further ado, here is Alex Ross Perry. So why don't we go through an update of your life right now for where you're at? Because every interview, I read through a bunch of them that we've done, and it actually seems like we begin on the same note, which is a brief debriefing of where you're currently at.
Logistically?
Well, besides being in Los Angeles, but in your life and your career.
Right. Well, I'm out here. My sixth movie, Her Smell, is playing tomorrow at the AFI Festival, which I've not been at since Color Wheel played in 2011. And Her Smell, it's the fourth project of mine to sort of be finished or be released in some form or another in 2018. Obviously, it's not going to come out until the spring, but, you know, in one form or another, Golden Exits, you know, was finally released in February, even though it had premiered over a year earlier. A movie I wrote called Nostalgia came out around the same time in February.
I saw that. I haven't seen the movie, but I saw that on your IMDb. Yeah.
And then Christopher Robin came out in August, and then Her Smell premiered in September. So, you know, it's a very much the clearing of the decks. I mean, including Christopher Robin and Golden Exits, both of which date back the longest of all of these. As of Toronto and as of Her Smell being finished, there's nothing in any state of creation that's not very, very early.
Right. Like not, that's not nascent.
Yeah. The four projects being all sort of out there in one form or another is a real clearing of the decks for everything that I've been working on for quite a while.
How does it feel to let all of it go, to be on like the finish line of this?
Well, again, they're all, you know, it's all staggered. I mean, like I said, you know, we're talking about the difference of a movie that was very small that had premiered at Sundance a year before it came out, mm-hmm. all the way up to, you know, a studio tent pole that I wrote, but then ultimately had very little to do with the making of. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really feel like anything because everything is different. The only thing that feels like something is her smell being written and worked on for several years and then made, edited, and premiered all within the same calendar year.
Can we go back to the first time that you found that you needed to write Her Smell?
Well, you never need to write anything. But
well, sometimes you have a job and you have to write something.
That's true. This certainly was not a job. I don't really know if I felt like I had to write it, but once I thought of the Becky character to be played by Lizzie Moss, which would have been summer of 2015, mm-hmm. between the Berlin premiere and then release of Queen of Earth. If I ever had to write it, it was just because I had sort of come up with a character that, to me, there is no precedent for in any movie.
Right.
But
it feels like a precedent for in real life.
Maybe. I mean, anything has a precedent in real life.
I was thinking of what musician, if any, that you were modeling this character after.
Certainly many. I mean, you know, on your continuum of inspired things, somewhere in that realm you have your Velvet Goldmine, where you can quite simply look at characters and say, well, this character is that. Mm-hmm. This is a Iggy Pop character. This is, and then I recently revisited Velvet Goldmine and I was reading about it online, and this woman is based on David Bowie's first wife. And to me, I think watching the movie, I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I'm not an encyclopedia of Bowie knowledge. I identify the things in the film that are based on his life. Velvet Goldmine has this little Berlin detour. I know that that's true, but then it says this character is based on his first manager.
Okay.
And I think, well, that's not apparent to me. To me, that character just is a character. And then you have your Boogie Nights and your The Master and your Phantom Threads, where you can sort of look at it and say, well, these are a little further away from real people.
Yeah.
You can look at a Boogie Nights and say there's a lot of similarities of John Holmes here, but they talk about John Holmes in the movie. So it's there, but it's all kind of next to it.
Well, his movies always feel like the most interesting versions of what those people would be like.
Yeah, and it's just, to me, what I see when I think about how those movies clearly exist is a compulsion and a fascination on the part of the writer.
With the character.
Who discovers a historical precedent for something that he is compelled to write about. Studies it a lot and then departs from it immediately. So to me, that's where I was trying to bring Her Smell in, much closer to that than something like Velvet Goldmine, which, you know, allegedly has this history of attempting to actually be a Bowie movie with authorized Bowie music. The other model is much more appealing to me. You know, he says, I read a biography of this fashion designer and I started thinking, what is it about that career? And then I start thinking, oh, you know, this is a character for someone I've worked with before. And then ultimately, the movie has nothing to do with anyone who was ever real. Mm-hmm. But then there's little tidbits in it where people say, oh, there's this character that's sort of similar to this. And that's closer to what I would have been thinking about in the research of Her Smell, which is reading a lot about music, which is a fun thing to do, to read about something.
It's a great thing to dive into.
Well, just to read about something that's
it's rich,
not meant to be read about, that's meant to be listened to.
Right. But the history of it is often compelling.
Very much so. And a lot of the things I was reading, it's under-examined. There's not a lot of books beyond occasional biographies or oral histories of punk musicians, grunge musicians, 90s mm-hmm. musicians. So it has to be looked at and then it has to be departed from as soon as narratively convenient.
What feels most unprecedented in this movie, I just finished watching it like 2 hours ago, so it's fresh in my head. It is one of the only music films I've ever seen that is mostly not about the music. It seems to be capturing every moment but the recording process, although there are scenes in the recording booth that are really riveting and intoxicating. It's not like a Ray. It's not like a biopic of like a musician. It is very much the in-between moments, the aftermath, the before, the after.
Right. Well, every cliche had to be avoided. This was very important to me in the writing. And if you've seen something in Ray or Walk the Line or Walk Hard, then there's no reason to put it.
I think Walk Hard's better than Walk the Line.
Oh, it certainly is.
Okay, is that a controversial opinion?
No, I think at this point, 10 years on, that's the accepted opinion.
Okay,
but if a biopic leans heavily on cliches, only because it has to. If you're making the Johnny Cash biopic, you need a scene where he writes Walk the Line, I guess. I don't know.
Well, this is a good example to bring up Bohemian Rhapsody, which I saw this past weekend, mm-hmm. which does exactly... it's the kind of movie where they're in the recording studio and someone's being like, we will...
Right.
And then Freddie Mercury's like, wow, mm-hmm. that's really good. And then they cut to Beijing and they're performing the song for millions of people.
That can be fun in a music movie, but for me, in an entirely fictional story... There's no point in making this movie if I can't do anything that I want.
Right.
And if you're telling a true story, whether it's phony or not, you have to acknowledge that a great song got written somehow. The most exciting way to do that is very corny, but you can't avoid it. But if you're doing Velvet Goldmine and you want to do a glam Bowie-esque story, but the place your story wants to go is, what if at the height of his fame, this character vanished forever? Mm-hmm. Which is not what happened to David Bowie, then you can just do that. So doing Her Smell, which is nothing but that, you can just do whatever you want. And to me, the fun of it is starting the way a normal music movie starts, with a big kind of final show of the tour performance.
Right. Which I was totally stunned by.
The performance?
Well, that you had shot that. I was like, what? Like, what movie is this? Like, I almost got psyched out to thinking you're making... a Bohemian Rhapsody-like film.
Yeah, that's meant to be, you know, familiar. The first 4 minutes of the movie are meant to feel safe and familiar.
Yeah, I mean, it's disarming.
It's a concert scene shot with a crane.
Yeah.
With overhead shots of an audience.
That's what I mean. I was like, Price Williams doing a crane? So I'm like very
confused.
Well,
you know, you bring in a crane guy.
Yeah.
But it's safe and it's a familiar beginning. Generally, the movie then would cut somewhere else. A cliche movie would cut to the band running out of the venue with fans throwing themselves at them.
Yeah. They're like running on the tour bus.
Sure. Something like that.
Yeah.
The thing you've never seen is the 21 minutes after that performance mm-hmm. in their entirety. So if doing something, you know, so you're saying, why did I have to write it? It's because I wanted to see the movie that had all the stuff in it you've never seen before.
You wanted to see how those interactions would have to play
out. Well, it's only about process and characters and drama and personality instead of professing to be an accurate depiction of something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can have a recording scene in a studio that's the moment where a hit song comes together. Or you can have something like the beginning of Nashville, which is just the execution of a hit song. Or you can have something like Sympathy for the Devil, which we looked at, which is just snapshots of moments of the boring part of recording a song. Or you can do what we did, which is 27 straight minutes in a recording studio where nothing gets done, no work gets accomplished, and a band breaks up because you've never seen that. And if you're doing anything that's even marginally adherent to a true story, you can't have that freedom unless that it happens to be the exact true story.
Mm-hmm.
So the compulsion to write the movie was just, Becky's a character that I need to write a movie about. 90s alternative girl punks. That's a movie I need to write a movie about. And then I want to think about this world, and I want to look at dozens of women and dozens of bands. And then I just want to think about whatever suits the drama most appropriately scene by scene. and then just throw everything out that I've seen in every other movie. You know, why, you know, I haven't seen Bohemian Rhapsody and I never will, but but like there's got to be some scene in
there. This is my favorite kind of comments you make.
There has to be some scene in there with a reporter talking to
them
about something they've done, saying, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole reporting sort of collage where a troop of reporters come in and they're trying to get Freddie Mercury to admit that he's bisexual.
Sure. And I hate the reporter scenes in anything. Like, yeah. Imagine if someone made a movie about me and it started with this. Like, nothing could be of less interest. So, you know, I don't.
Thank you.
So there can't be, because this doesn't say anything. It's such a dramatic false construction to assume that the moment where a person sits opposite a microphone is a moment where they reveal the key to a dramatic telling of their life. Mm-hmm. So I had to write her smell.
Well,
so
you know what you'd have to do? You'd have to play out this interview and film it for an hour.
Right. Well, then you have something interesting. Then you have whatever, my dinner with Andre or something. But like
something like that.
You know, so I had to write her smell so that there was a music movie on record that doesn't have the reporter, doesn't have the fans, doesn't have someone talking about, you have to promote the album, we need you to do this, and this person saying, no, I don't want to do any press. Like, just to take every cliche out and then take away every safety net of normal writing, which is most scenes are 4 minutes long.
To me, it makes a lot of sense that this film came on the heels of Queen of Earth, because you're talking about these two sequences in particular, which is the thing that follows the Crane musical opening, which is 20-something minutes backstage. And then you're talking about the scene in the studio. Both of these scenes, I think, are going to test people's patience. It's just going to test an audience. You could say every scene is a test of someone, tested of an audience. But I think these especially, like Queen of Earth, I'm thinking back on, that movie seemed to really challenge people. It seemed that, I think of all the movies that you've made, I think that was maybe the hardest one for people to swallow.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I will say it seems to be the one that people have seen the most. It's certainly the one that people mentioned to me the most. And it's the one that has gotten me the most, not work, but the most people that have reached out to me to say, can I talk to you or can I work with you or I love you? They're saying it because of that movie.
Well, I think you either really like it or you don't.
Right. Both music videos that I did in the last couple of years were people who wrote to say that they liked Queen of Earth and asked if I'd want to do something with them. But, you know, yeah, I don't know. I guess in the case of this movie, knowing that the challenge was to lean very far into a whirlwind hurricane of a character was to give myself the permission that this movie should feel like that. It's one thing to make a movie that feels like that about quote-unquote normal people in quote-unquote normal circumstances. Mm-hmm. But to say, you know, this is going to be a movie that has five scenes. Each one will be somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes. And they're just straight through with no breaks. Then you're allowed, you know, then the sort of arduousness is written into it. It's not a projection of people's exhaustion with the movie. The tedium of enduring a 26-minute scene is something that is a part of it no matter what. So that was always something I was curious to test.
Do you have any apprehension about spending so much time with people that are, I will call them, vaguely unpleasant?
In the movie?
In the movie, yeah. I'm thinking also about, listen to Philip got a lot of talk about this.
Yeah.
I've never talked about that before.
Well, I just think the only thing I can say about this, increasingly, as time goes on and as this continues to be my only answer, is that, you know, there are, let's say, 9 main characters in Her Smell. There's 7 women in 2 bands and an extra woman who's not in a band, and then 2 men. 9 main characters. I would argue, and I would be compelled to hear a counter argument, because I don't think there is one, that 8 of them are absolutely either neutral or incredibly sympathetic. And if they're sympathetic, it's because of the circumstances that they're in, which all relate to one character.
Right.
So I think that if 8 of your 9 main characters are either positive people or deeply sympathetic because of how much your heart breaks for them having their entire lives tethered to a sinking ship of a woman, then I don't think an 8-to-1 ratio really qualifies for an unpleasant assortment of characters. And I think that, to me, again, this is the only answer I can ever have. It's not that there's 9 characters trying to one-up each other in terms of their insanity.
Mm-hmm.
The Becky character is deliberately, forcefully, intentionally, and violently difficult and horrible for 3/5 of the movie. And then 8 people surrounding her suffer from that from the very, very beginning of the film.
Yeah.
To me, that is very obviously the point of telling stories about a difficult character. If all people can see is Becky, then there's something wrong in the way that they're watching the editing and the other performances, because the movie is not about Becky exclusively. Mm. It's about Becky's effect on 9 other people. So, yeah, Becky's very difficult for most of the movie. But if you have any empathy, then you probably look at the other 8 and go, this is not unpleasant.
Not easy for them.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
And therefore, this is what the movie's trying to tell me.
I think I have a better question, the more specific one, which is, I've done much less of this than you have, but I'm wading into it now, which is to spend time with the people that you're writing on page, and then to cast someone, and then to be on set and like be in that presence and that aura of that character. Does it weigh on you at all to have to, not to have to, but to be making this movie about, yes, it's about these other 8 people grappling with this one person, but a majority of the screen time is her like on screen dominating. And if she's not there on screen, her presence looms. I don't know. Does she weigh on you at all? Like when you're shooting in the act of the set?
Does Becky as a fictional character?
Yeah, because you're in that space. You have to keep creating in that space.
No. I mean,
you can disassociate.
Well, I mean, she's around, but this is the point of the movie. I mean, there's no movie if she's not all that she needs to be.
Yeah.
So, also, she's there. I mean, Lizzie worked every day but one of the shoot. The one day she didn't work is the part of Act 3 where Becky is missing. So she's just around all the time. And this is just the nature of this movie. But that, you know, again, comes after making Golden Exits, where of the 7 main characters, nobody worked more than half of the shoot. So she kind of just has to be there. But it doesn't weigh. I mean, it's not that it's art. I mean, it weighs on her.
Mm.
But by the time we're shooting, it's all on her. I have nothing left to say about the character that I haven't said to her in the previous 3 years of talking about it.
It's on Lizzie.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly weighed on her to be creating that atmosphere 12 hours a day.
Mania.
Yeah. Well, it's just hard to keep up because the scenes are 30 pages long and we're generally doing 12 pages a day.
Yeah.
So yeah, it weighed on her. But I mean, the only thing for me was just corralling it.
This is a personal question. I was watching it and it reminded me of someone I do know. Someone that I have spent a lot of time with.
Hmm.
Have you met or been in the same space as someone like that?
Well, to some extent. I mean, if you're saying someone who is a destructive addict, then yes. Simply put, I mean, there's no movie without my understanding of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no movie without my empathy for the family member or the significant other or the business partner or the creative partner of an addict living with that. That is so much of the movie. As I just said, that is 8 of the 9 main, that 8 of the 9 main characters, that is their biggest problem in the movie.
Mm.
So I've had that. And that's, I think, relatable to probably the majority of people have dealt with that.
Right.
I've never been around someone whose creative force is something that my life and my livelihood are dependent upon.
Right.
Who is also that addict. But there are degrees of this in various reaches of life that is that's my way into this movie. I mean, I've never been in a band. I've never toured. I've never hung out in venues. My way in is through this.
Is it helpful to just dive into the research part of this and not have it be so solely based on like your own experiences?
No, I mean, there's nothing without the experiences. And then the research is writing for a couple of years while thinking about and reading about and listening to a certain kind of music, which I knew as a fan, but didn't know the history of some of these records that I liked. Or, you know, you read a 33 and a third book about a great album and you learn about what the artist was going through in the making of it and the response to it at its initial release. And these are all things I don't know. The movie doesn't really have much to do with this, but it's just a pleasant way to kind of keep the brain focused on it. Some women in rock are incredibly well adjusted, never seem to have struggled in the way that Becky does. Some struggled and because of that never became successful. She's a character who, you know, takes bits and pieces. She struggles mightily. She's also fairly successful. The same cannot be said of many, but, you know, there is no, in the case of this movie, the ambition of which was density to an extent that I'd never attempted before. There's no way to have too much, you know, to be telling an addiction story and a story about creatives spiraling and ever so slightly a story about music industry in the 90s, but really that's like a C or a D plot.
Yeah.
If at all, because that's not what the movie's about. That's just where the movie lives. So there's no, you know, if there's a balance for this, I don't really see it as like a hindrance or a help. It just kind of is what the movie has to be.
After Her Smell and Listen Up, Philip, I want to know, where do you stand on the conversation of great artists often being really terrible people?
Well, I guess romantically, you sort of just assume that it's a given. And you think that because this is largely the narrative that you get when you read a history book.
Is that romantic?
Well, it's not a romantic notion, but it's romantic in that you spend a period of your life loving a piece of work. And then when you love it so much, you want to read about the person who made it.
Right. You're often...
You're swept up in the piece. If you don't like something enough to read a book about the person who made it, then you'll never know anything about them. And therefore, the work didn't affect you very strongly. It's a weird double-edged sword. People don't talk about this that much. That if you don't care about Rosemary's Baby, then it doesn't matter.
Or don't care enough.
You're right. If you don't like horror movies and you've never seen it, then you don't really need to grapple with the reality of one of the thousands of people who made that movie. This only becomes a problem when you really love something. So that is kind of romantic.
That's interesting. Now I'm thinking, you know, there's been so much talk about like Woody Allen. And I do wonder, now that you said it like this, how many people who really don't like him have seen a lot of his movies?
I don't know. I mean, who's to say? But you only have to grapple with the reality of whatever public narrative and personal narrative surrounds artists if you care about their work.
Right.
You know, there's someone in the art world or someone in, you know, this happens, you know, whatever, the conductor of the Met or whatever that was, one of those controversies. This is someone I'd never heard of until they were publicly shamed and taken down. So therefore, I don't have to do anything to try to grapple with my...
It's not weighing on you.
Right, because I've never heard of this person until the day that I read that they're potentially up to no good and that they've been fired. So, you know, but that's the thing, is that I think that these two movies that you ask about anyway, like the pain of the person in those movies is fairly harmless. They're not really hurting anybody except for a dozen or so people in their immediate orbit.
Right.
And both of these movies, you know, people say Her Smell is very difficult, very abrasive, and very challenging. And to me, it's just trash talk. I mean, this woman, she does get a little physically abrasive sometimes, but it's essentially, she's just using foul language.
Yeah.
That's not a high enough bar to say, you know, a great artist who's a terrible person. But you know what I mean? Like, that's a valid question to talk about if I made a movie about a great artist who murdered somebody. But
right.
These are two movies about talented people who just are very obnoxious and insulting. And also, privately, this is an important thing also in Her Smell, is that the public never catches on. Right. As far as we know, to any of Becky's behavior. Of course, you would have to assume, even in the 90s, that there would be an article or an MTV News something about the band breaking up.
Right. Well, there's some documentary crew that's there.
Right. But you don't know what happens with that footage. So, like, her actions are pretty low stakes. I mean, she's just in a recording studio screaming at people.
Mm.
I like to think that no artist should be held to that low of a bar of good behavior. You're allowed to yell at people you work with sometimes.
I mean, it happens.
If there's two of them, you can't yell at 100 people. But if you're in a three-person band, I think you can yell. If you're making a movie with three people, I think you can yell sometimes. But you shouldn't yell at the audience.
As an artist, who have you had to grapple with?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know. I probably fall pretty far to the margins of that sort of a problem.
What does that mean?
It means that I probably think about it as little as possible while still thinking about it.
Because?
Because I like movies. And I don't really care about people as much as I care about good movies.
This makes sense.
No, but you know what I mean. Like, it's a new thing to think about. And I think that, or it's a new thing to be overwhelmed by thinking about.
I think it's a new thing to think about so actively and publicly. Right. I don't think it's new to think about it in general.
No, I'm sure it's existed in some form or another, but it's new to really have to wonder about it. And I guess I just think that the parabola of time is very long and curved. And I'm only ever thinking about things just because of my love of immediate history. Not in the long term, not in the terms of 100 years, but I'm more predisposed to think about something in terms of 10 years, 20 years, periods of time that I understand because I've lived through them. My grappling is more just like, it's less how do I feel about something made by someone who's controversial, but more like, do I show this work to a child in 20 years?
Mm.
Because I just believe, like, for me personally, like, I can't take away the meaning of something to myself. I can give it no future meaning.
Right.
But I personally just can't remove the significance of something that has existed in me for however long. So my question is only, is there a good faith version of showing this to a teenager who's interested in cinema at some point in the future? Or is that... is that something that's not going to happen? That's a more fun way for me to approach these things, because it's not fun to think about, like, pretending that I haven't seen a movie that I love 50 times.
Right. And then there's the question of, do we have some moral or ethical obligation to think about those things that are not fun?
Right. I mean,
not as people who, like, people may know, but as humans in the world.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that means either, but, you know...
I love when I say something and you're like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the obligations are of humans in the world, but I feel like in this movie, you have a excitable, loud, vulgar, creative person.
Mm.
But also, and this is something that I find interesting... in reading or just hearing people's responses to the movie at Q&As or whatnot, there's nothing in the movie that points to this one way or the other. But when someone says, like, oh, well, you know, the character is a self-destructive genius.
Mm.
I think, like, well, what is it about the three songs of hers that you heard in this movie
that's genius,
that makes you think she's a genius?
Yeah.
Instead of an above average punk singer.
Yeah. Or a self-destructive musician who seems to be acclaimed or,
right.
You know, people so, like her. We know that.
So to me, like, the excitement and the rush to judgment to say, I watched a movie about someone who is a creative, therefore they're a genius, or else they wouldn't have made a movie about them.
Mm-hmm.
That speaks to people's need to ascribe the largest possible words and the largest possible emotions and feelings
to justify bad behavior
to everything. Yes. Because if she's not a genius, why would all this drama happen? And to me, it's like, well, that's a valid reading, but she's, you know, like an alternative punk singer on a medium major label in the 90s. Like, she can only be so much of a genius. I can think that people who wrote that music are genius. But if you're going to watch this movie and say that Becky's a genius and I play you a Veruca Salt album, are you going to say that these women are geniuses too? Or are you just going to say these women could write some hooks? Really talented pop guitarists and grunge singers. Or are they geniuses? To me, some of that music is genius. But you're right to think that once you see a personality that huge, people just think, well, no one would put up with her if she wasn't a genius.
Right.
But we see no signs of that. I mean, also, what is the bar for genius for three-minute, you know, three-chord punk music? Like, what is, where does that, what, how does someone become a genius in that world? But what's become obvious to me is that people need an artist or a fictional character. They just need them to be the most. They need them to be a genius or a monster.
Well, they don't want to think they've just spent 2.5 hours watching a movie about someone who is self-destructive, kind of unkind, no, very unkind when under the influence, and just sort of like a middling talent.
Right. And, you know, this is what I say, like, there's two barometers in the movie of success. One is that they get a platinum record, which is hard to do, but a lot of people do it, or they did at the time. It's not the hardest thing in the world. If you have a hit single, you could probably go platinum. The second thing is that they're on the cover of Spin, which is much harder to do.
Right.
Only 12 acts could do that a year.
Well, you and I will probably never do either.
Well, that is correct. But in terms of music, you see the band clear two professional milestones. Neither one, to me, points at this is the biggest, most important band in the world. But also neither one points me at, why am I watching a movie about this band? They're not successful or relevant at all. But also, again, because of my aversion to the cliches, we never see a meeting with the label. We never see fans. We never see, when we see fans in the crowd, but we never see them interacting with the band.
Right.
So none of that stuff is on the table. And I think people just want to look at something and say, well, this woman's the genius. She's clearly the most important and most successful figure in alternative music at the time that this movie takes place. And I think if you need her to be, she is. Nothing in the movie says that she is or isn't.
I want to backtrack to something you said earlier. When did you realize in your life that movies were more important to you than people?
Well, I had so much more time with them.
Growing up?
Oh, yeah.
Because for people who don't know, you not only have an encyclopedic knowledge of film, maybe more than anyone I know, top three or four, but you also
I hope that's not true, but I hope you know more people than that.
I was trying to give you a compliment.
Well, thank you.
Now I have to reconsider. But the second thing is that you catalog what you've seen very meticulously. So, but the larger question is something I've not heard you say. Is that you do consider movies more important than...
Right. Well, not all people.
Of course not.
Like I would...
And not all movies.
I mean, movies made me feel less alone when I was growing up. And people made me feel more alone when I was made fun of at school and picked on and so on and so forth. So this is like the ages of 10 to 16 or so.
It was 10 to 16, so not even...
Well, by 16, I had some friends.
Right.
But I feel like
by the end of high school, you were fine.
Well, by the middle of high school, things turned around. But I feel like there was a good 6 or 7 years in the middle where I only remember playing video games and watching videotapes in my basement.
What were people making fun of you?
Well, I had long hair, not particularly long, about the length of yours right now. And I was... mercilessly made fun of and picked on and called words that you used to say a little bit more casually and now you don't. But I was called very, to me, bizarrely, emphatically hateful words.
Because of your long hair.
Just for having long hair and, like, you know, wearing weird clothes and not having a lot of friends, not being on a sports team. And, you know, you go home from the end of that. You put on a tape and everything's fine.
It made you feel less lonely.
Well, certainly. But also, people die and art doesn't. So I think history could probably say that I'm onto something.
Yeah. I mean, that is a true statement. It's a pretty basic statement.
Very basic.
But I had not considered that. Is that why you're closer to movies?
Well, I don't know if that's still true. I mean, now that I have a wife and, you know, a nicer quality of life than I did when I was 11. But things are all very temporary, seemingly.
Movies are less so.
If you want them to be. I mean, if you have it within you to love a film and then decide later in your life that you can never look at it again, then it too is temporary. Then you can turn your back on it the way you can turn your back on a friend or a significant other that you have a big breakup with. Intriguingly, to sort of throw another curveball here, as I'm saying that I don't have the kind of brain to just say I can never look at this movie again, I do have that brain with women I've dated. I can just break up and say I will literally never talk to this person again.
You just like cut it off.
It's not that I cut it off. It's that I see no reason for there to be a future in having any kind of check-in relationship in the way that a movie that may have fallen from grace for one reason or another, I still might watch it every 4 or 5 years. I don't see people every 4 or 5 years.
So you're more forgiving of mediocre movies than middling relationships.
Yeah, maybe.
What about maintaining a friendship with that woman after?
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't see any.
It's not possible.
This is something that Lizzie and I bonded over when we were making Listen Up, Philip, was that, you know, in the conversations and the rehearsals of that movie with her and Jason, it just, a lot of the talking about that movie was, what is your relationship with someone through and after a breakup? Hmm. And Jason said, I've always stayed friends with people. And Lizzie and I said, scorched earth. Always. And just never see that person again. Really? Or never talk to them. Yeah, and her and I bonded very much over that.
Scorched earth. That's tough. I mean, have people tried to maintain a relationship and then they're like,
no.
And then you say no?
No, they don't want to.
They just know that you're...
Yeah, it's over.
Out.
No, they don't want anything to do with me either.
I wonder where that comes from for you.
I don't know.
Your parents are together, aren't they?
No, they're not.
They split up.
Yeah. Relationships always, you know, those ones anyway, always end bad. I mean, I haven't had an ex-girlfriend for over 10 years.
Right.
So it's an irrelevant thing at this point. But yeah, I don't, those relationships disappear, and I never think every 5 years, it's been a while, but I should check in with them. But for better or worse, I will probably think that about Rosemary's Baby for the rest of my life. Every 5 years, I'll think, I should check back in with that.
Do you think you're a forgiving person?
I don't know. I've never really had to forgive anything particularly exciting.
Really?
Well, I'm sure there are little things, but, you know, I'm sure I'm working towards it. But there'd only be two options. One would be I can be forgiving, which is, I think, in the case of Her Smell, very much a hopeful message that runs throughout the movie, especially Acts 4 and 5, which I believe in and I want to work towards. And then the other aspect of this is I have to turn my back to you and I'm not going to see you anymore, which is how Philip ends. Mm. But I really wanted this movie to engage with that as a potential outcome for these people. Mm. And I'm very happy with the idea in Acts 4 and 5 of the movie that all of the damage and all of the pain and all of the insults can be forgiven. But, you know, that comes, this is again the addiction subplot of the movie. This is Mari and Allie and Howard forgiving Becky, but also only after she's kind of come to terms with herself. Mm. They don't forgive her until she hits rock bottom and stays there for 2 years. And then she asks for forgiveness and they give it to her. So it's kind of a two-part process. I believe in that as a two-part process. If someone asks for forgiveness, it would be impossible to not give it. But it would also be very difficult to just show up on someone's doorstep when you haven't talked to them in 5 years and just say, I forgive you. Mm. That seems crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be pretty difficult.
It'd be very weird, yes. It'd be very strange, and I believe probably fairly uncommon.
When you think back on making movies in your 20s, you made a handful. You were someone who seemed to be pretty productive and proactive about wanting to be a writer-director, not so much in Hollywood, but just in the world, especially in New York. Do you have any regrets about that time? Like the way we know a bunch of people who, like, they start doing well, they become more asshole-ish the better they do. And it's often the time in their 20s in which they become, like, peak asshole.
I don't know. I mean, it depends how much you know people.
Yeah.
It depends how...
But let's...
It depends how closely you rely on somebody. And this is clearly something that I was very much thinking about.
And definitely in her smell.
In the making of Philip, and then up through her smell is like, well, Philip being much more about the youthful period that you're describing.
Right, you know? Which is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how much you rely on somebody, and it depends how much people validate you. And Philip, everyone pretty much turns their back to him mm-hmm. as soon as they get wind of what he's on, what he's up to. And her smell, people really don't turn their back on Becky until there's no other choice or until she basically demands that they quit.
In your 20s, did you feel a kinship with Philip?
No. I mean, he was always there to sort of examine that behavior without actually doing it myself. I mean, certainly I got pretty close at times to things that are in that movie. But there's multiple aspects of what you're talking about. There's productivity, and then there's the success that at 25, 26, 27 is very meaningful. And at 35 is irrelevant. The same metric of success 10 years later would not mean the same thing. So being young is, I think, sort of tethered to the necessity of feeling very proud and satisfied of fairly irrelevant accomplishments. Because you're young and you have the time to be satisfied. Then the other side of that is how much people validate you for that, which again is only really useful when you're on the younger side.
Did you feel validated at that age?
Well, tremendously. I mean, even Impolex and Color Wheel at festivals was all the validation in the world a 25-year-old needs to write and make their third movie. You know, we're here again at AFI screening Color Wheel here on Hollywood Boulevard and the Chinese Theater at 26 or, you know, whatever. There's no greater validation than that. And it was a very nice screening. And the same thing wouldn't mean the same to me now.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it was very, very useful and very validating. So that's another thing that can only happen at that age.
Did it make you feel like you could do this as a job?
Oh, certainly. I thought if I can make it this far with movies that are this cheap and this sort of ramshackle, handmade, poorly made. If I can make it to this point with these, then if I can pull something off for real, the sky is the limit. And this is a young person's thought. This would be an insane thing to think when you're 35 or 40.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, if you haven't figured out how to advance yourself, then there's something worth examining. But you know, there's nothing that I regret. I mean, I feel like everything was on the path and not to be sort of opportunistic about it, but all the things, even the bad ones, bouts of arrogance or bad behavior, all of that got to the point where I am now, which is the ability to basically only work on what I want to work on, the ability to earn a living doing something, you know, working in an industry where that is a hard bar to get across. So if I had been slightly nicer to people and slightly less of an obnoxious, confident 25-year-old.
Is that what you were?
Oh, sure. Well, like I'm saying, you have to be when you're being flown across the country to Hollywood Boulevard to present a movie like The Color Wheel. I mean, that's a confidence boost if there ever was one. And maybe if I'd been a little bit more humble about that, it would have been a little bit harder to get to the next step. But, you know, there was never any burning bridges at that time. I'm still friends with almost everybody I was friends with then, and a lot of those people that I met that year at festivals are still very important friends and collaborators. Some people fall away or some people are pushed away or whatever, but that's all fine. It's all a journey. It's all just a means to an end. I was at the festival here, you know, like I said, 7 years ago. If I thought 7 years later I'd be back in the same stupid hotel with a movie that cost, I think, 100 times as much as The Color Wheel. You know, with wall-to-wall, terrific actors, famous people, less famous people, legends like Eric Stoltz. And I would know that I came out here and, you know, I can walk into the El Capitan gift shop and see merchandise for a Disney movie that I wrote. And that I have, you know, other opportunities coming up to do things that are incredibly surreal to be working on. 7 years ago, I would just say, what do I have to do to stay on the path that takes me to that future? Whereas now I'm there and I can, you know, earn a living and, like I said, have insurance and support myself and have a house and do these things. Somehow it all ends up doing that. It's all a continuum.
How do you feel about the friends that didn't make it?
don't think about him. I mean, this is what we were just saying. I don't have the relationship with them. I don't check in with them. You hear tell sometimes, or you see a little public notification of somebody and you think, that's interesting. Or you think, I don't hear about that person. I wonder why.
Because there was a lot of people in New York, I imagine, in your 20s that you were working with or that you were in proximity to that all wanted to do a thing. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't mean it was a director. Maybe it's a writer, an actor, whatever. A lot of people in their 20s have desires to do something in the arts.
Right.
When that transition happens, when like it is clearly working out for you and you are coming out here to do the color wheel, mm-hmm. and things are going better, would you just drop people? I don't think you're that kind of person.
No, I wouldn't. There's a couple people that there was a specific incident with, all of which I can honestly say were entirely their fault. you know, it just doesn't matter. I mean, it's the gross version of this answer is you only really need people who you need. If someone can't help you, and that doesn't mean give you a job or give you money, but that might just mean emotionally be a supportive person or someone who gives great notes on a script or a cut, or someone who you call for advice when you are up for a job that is similar to something they've done. If you don't need someone, then you don't need them. Mm-hmm. And I need a lot of people to do what I do. There's a lot of friends who are filmmakers whose opinions I trust, and there's a lot of craftspeople who I couldn't make movies without, and I haven't for 5 years made a movie without a lot of these people. I need those people. I need them to do what I want to do. I need them to feel inspired to write. You know, I need Lizzie Moss to be inspired to write her smell. I need her very badly. I also need her to say she'll make the movie so that the movie gets made. Mm-hmm. So I literally need her. But then there's just, you know, friends who I really need them to, I need to hear their opinions when I'm having an issue, when I'm describing to them, should I pursue this job? Should we take this distribution offer? Should we go for these festivals instead of those festivals? I need their advice. I need their friendship. So it's not that they're offering me anything material, but they have something very valuable. And if you don't need people, then you don't need them.
I have the more specific question. This is the second time this has happened where I've asked something, you've answered it, and I thought, okay, I know what the real question is.
And I'm supposed to have a different answer.
Well, no, you can answer however you want. This is a free speech here. What was the difference between the people that ended up in a successful place, whatever that means, and an unsuccessful place, which in this case will be they didn't do the thing they wanted to do?
Right. Well, I mean, you don't know that about people. Maybe people did do the thing they wanted to do. It's impossible to say unless I have on the record someone telling me at AFI Fest 7 years ago, in 2018, this is what I want to be doing, and now I can look and say, well, you're not doing it. So you never know. I mean, the question always, and this is like a very obvious platitude that comes up in young life a lot, is you have a goal for yourself and then you achieve it, and your life is exactly the same. This is obviously what Listen Up Philip is very much about. You reach these new milestones, nothing in your life changes, and you think, I used to think if I could do this, I would be happy, but I just did it. Now I'm not. So now what do I do? And maybe some people...
What movie was that for you?
Of what?
In your career. You thought, if I can make this movie, then I think I'm going to be happy.
Well, it was something like, if I can get to a point where I'm being taken seriously, or I'm being flown to these places, or I'm being given the opportunity to present the work for this type of an audience. And certainly Color Wheel was the turning point for that, where I was invited to dozens of festivals, attended every one of them all over the world, now breaking into the international festival community. You know, and again, I was 25, 26, 27 when that movie was out in the world. And I thought, at 20, if I can get to that point, then everything will be great. And of course, everything was not great because I was poor. None of this was paying me a dime. And I would be given a round trip ticket to another country in a hotel room. And I would go home and have to do everything I could not to spend money. So then, you know, part of that is saying, I always assumed if I got to that accomplishment, then my life would be so easy. But perhaps for some people, they get to that accomplishment and they think, this is really all I ever needed. Mm. I can focus my energies elsewhere right now. It's much more valuable for me to always say, well, now I would like to do this. Now I would like to try this. So maybe people who become less productive or less visibly productive as time goes on, maybe they're just finding other things to satisfy themselves with. I don't know them, so I don't know. Mm. I certainly have plenty of friends that are filmmakers that I see all the time. And they're always complaining, as am I, about the project you can't get going and the money that you can't get. I mean, I have very few people who don't have that problem in my life. So to the outside, someone might go, but that person is a beacon of success.
Right.
Their movies have been at Sundance and distributed by great companies. And I say, yeah, but that's my friend. When I talk to them, believe me, they are not satisfied with the opportunities they have.
It's always about the money, too.
So to an extent. I mean, if you're working in a medium that is dependent upon it.
Hmm. Has it gotten easier for you?
A little bit. I mean, I had a movie of my own creation that I wrote and then directed with actors that I've adored and loved and been honored to collaborate with in 2014, 15, 17, and 18. It would be very strange if my answer to that question wasn't, yes, it has gotten easier. But I've also, you know, just grown at the right pace. You know, a movie the size of Her Smell, the resources, the infrastructure, the budget. I couldn't have made that movie after Listen Up, Philip.
You weren't ready.
No one would have given me the chance at the time. And I wasn't ready, and I couldn't have handled it all. I needed to make a couple smaller movies and let the work speak for itself and become a better writer and let Lizzie kind of show people another side of her work in Handmaid's Tale and become an even more exciting prospect for other actors to want to collaborate with and for producers to want to work with than she was when we made Philip or Queen of Earth. But only 4 years separate those two movies.
Right.
But yeah, it's gotten a little bit easier. And then, you know, other things get easier. Maybe it will get harder now to make my own movie that I've written, as I've done 6 times. But at the same time, it'll get easier to write something for money for a company that's going to now pay my rent.
Right. Well, so this has been the like B plot of your life in a lot of ways, is you're getting paid, I imagine, pretty well to write these movies that Alex Ross Perry would never direct.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter to you that the movies you've directed are not funding your life in a way?
Well, no, just because obviously I have other things that are.
Of course. Like, I guess the better question is the money, or rather the tickets sold, mm-hmm. at all a barometer you have for yourself?
Only because I would like to eventually have a movie of my own that I can say without a doubt was seen by the right amount of people.
What's that?
Well,
what's
you never right know, amount? But everything has a sort of maximum potential. If you took a poll of people across the country, people who are prone to seeing a movie, and you said, would you want to see a movie where Jason Schwartzman plays a young novelist in Brooklyn and Elizabeth Moss is in it and has this kind of a conceit, more people would say, yes, I would like to see that movie than have seen that movie. And I would like to have a situation where if you did the same opinion poll and said, would you like to see a movie where Elizabeth Moss plays a punk singer and there's this younger band and Cara Delevingne plays the drums in the movie and it has all this original music and Eric Stoltz is in it. I think a lot of people, not a lot, you know, by independent movie terms, of course, every audience is very spread across the world right now, but a handful of people would say, yeah, that movie sounds good. I'd like to finally have a movie, maybe this will be the one, where all of the people who think that movie sounds like it's up my alley will see the movie.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like generally the movies reach a fraction of the audience of people who say, actually, that movie sounds like my kind of thing. I should see it.
Here's what I like about Her Smell. There's a lot of things. But I love the idea of someone going into a theater. There's two people, and there's one person.
This sounds like a parable. It sounds like this is going to turn into some sort of a...
No parable. One person who loves Cara Delevingne, mm-hmm. and one person who's like, I love Eric Stoltz.
Uh-huh.
And that they could possibly be sitting next to each other in the same theater for the same movie.
Yeah.
It's such a lovely idea in my head. It's like two worlds colliding,
yes.
in some way.
And in the ancient, you know, Native American sense,
parable.
Both of those people are me. And the question is which dog wins the fight, and the answer is whichever one I feed the most. Do I feed my Stoltz fandom or my Cara fandom? So
which one did you feed more?
I mean, on set, Stoltz. I fed the Stoltz fandom on set. And he fed it.
He did?
Well, he's just the most charming, gregarious, present, humorous person I've ever been around. He's in a league only with Schwartzman in terms of his just ability to bring joy to people the second he is around them for 12 hours a day for a month at a time.
So Cara Delevingne lost.
You can't compete with Stoltz. You can't compete with his personality. He's also, as we said, whenever we would notice his astonishing precision of performance, we just said, he's been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, he's been doing it a long time.
It's been a lot of years.
He can create a cult around himself on set.
Mm.
Whereas Kara just has a cult around herself. They're waiting outside once they learn where she's shooting, trying to get a picture of her.
Right.
Very different than Stoltz's cult.
Very strange. Very different. One of the last things I want to ask before we go. What is the thing you needed to learn in Philip and Queen of Earth and Golden Exits to get you to be able to do her smell in a way that is effective?
The biggest thing is the crew. I mean,
managing that many people.
Well, not even that, because the crew size of her smell wasn't that much bigger than the crew size of Golden Exits. It's all the same people, all the same department heads. But our production coordinator, who's my friend Craig, who's in all the movies, he plays the roadie at the end of Her Smell, and he's you know, the sort of drunk friend in Golden Exits. He just said, you couldn't even step to this movie if you didn't know your team would deliver. And that's a four-movie lesson, is writing a movie for a makeup designer who I can write to when I'm writing it and say, is it practical that there are going to be days on this movie where there are going to be seven women with insane hair and makeup, total glam, sweaty, glittery, streaky makeup, punk women, seven on a day? Is that possible? And I have a hair and makeup people that can answer those questions for me while I'm writing. And you can say to a production design team, is it possible that we could build all of these sets rather than finding them? Can you do that if we give you all the money and all the resources you need within the realm of this budget? So it's just knowing that the crew will deliver was the hugest lesson that those three movies brought into this one. It's just that every one of these people who, this is now our fourth movie together, every one of those people I never thought for a second from pre-production onward. I hope they do a good job. But then the other lesson coming from the other side is just the Christopher Robin writing lesson. Like, I couldn't have written Her Smell if I didn't spend 3 years writing Christopher Robin. I learned more about writing than I ever thought there was to learn making that script for all those years.
What did you learn?
I mean, too many things that you can get into. But, you know, I learned proper technique, to use the term of a fine artist or the term of a chef or a self-taught musician. I learned proper technique to, you know, allude to a moment in Her Smell. I was like a musician that couldn't read music, and I learned how to read music.
Mm.
That is what happened while writing that movie and working with the producers at Disney. And it informed how I was able to then, for a couple of years, write Her Smell in a way that I found to be airtight and satisfying for all of the dramatic purposes that I was attempting to find within the movie. So that was the only thing of myself that I was bringing in, because everything else was just creating the biggest possible challenge for 10 people who I think can handle any challenge.
Mm.
You know, in front of the camera, behind the camera, editing, composing, graphic design, like 10 or 12 people that I think can handle any challenge, and me trying to think of a movie that was the biggest challenge for all of them. And then the end result is that every one of these people said to me, this is like my dream project to get to work on. The hair and makeup department was telling me this at the wrap party. Every one of them said, you know, this is like the kind of project you never get, where you get to set a look that's this huge and then replicate it for 4 days. All the art team said, this is the kind of project you never get. It's the dream project. Get to build sets this big with that many props, period props from a period that we grew up in. It's a dream project. The lighting people said, you know, this is a dream project. Everybody said it. And I thought, good, that was kind of the goal, to have the entire crew at the rap party say, this was kind of a dream project. This is the kind of thing I've always wanted to do. And I just said, well, you know, this is our fourth movie together. So now I have to find something for the fifth one that you'll all feel the same way about.
Did you have any moment in the lead up to making this movie or even on this on the shoot of it where you know you're bringing in all these same people from the past film, from the past films, and you know they're going to deliver? I mean, you're hoping, but I think in your gut, you know that they're capable and they've told you that they're capable. Mm-hmm. Do you have any self-doubt?
Well, it would be very difficult if I did. I mean, yes, of course, because I'm a human being. There was a lot less of it on this movie than there ever has been before. Because if I had the self-doubt, then why are all these great people here to make this movie? If I doubt myself, just look around. Hmm. There's Lizzie, there's Stoltz, there's Kara, there's this crew that I love. There's nothing to doubt when you look around and that's what you see. And you look at the sets that have been built and you look at the crew just working. So it's pretty easy to have self-doubt on the subway ride to the set. And then you get there and you look around and you think, no, I mean,
they're all here for me.
If I had anything to doubt, then all these people wouldn't be here and all this amazing work wouldn't be getting done.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you leave it at the, if it's there, you leave it at the door. Mm. And then it goes away incrementally as the shoot goes on. I had never come into a movie of the six as confident as this one. And hopefully I can do that again next time. But I came in to prep and to the shoot of this incredibly confident, even though one day before the shoot, Lizzie was saying to me, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And I just said, well, I'm sure you'll be great. She goes, I'm really nervous. There's a lot about Becky I haven't figured out yet, and I'll figure it out when we're shooting. I'm really nervous. I said, I'm not. You're going to be great. Nothing to worry about. Complete confidence. And she said, no, I guess that's what I needed to hear.
Right.
And then we never really talked about it again, and everything was just fine from there on out.
And she delivered.
Of course. I knew she would.
You said earlier that it may be a cliche, but we look at these things as we create, and we set these goals, these ideas that, okay, once we do this, I will be happy. Mm-hmm. And you said that's something especially people do in their 20s because they know nothing else and that's all they have. And they ought to be that sort of bullish and proud. Now that you are in your 30s and you've made six movies and things are going well and money is no longer an issue, unlike most people in independent cinema.
Well, money's an issue. I'm not. I don't know how well you think I'm doing.
Less of an issue. Let's say less of an issue. What do you want for yourself?
I just want to work. I mean, I just want to work with the same people, and then I want to work with new people that excite me.
Is there a new, larger goal?
Yeah, I mean, of course. But now I no longer look at it as like, oh, all I wanted to do was make a movie at this budget level that played at Toronto, and then I thought my life would be so easy, and now I've done that. What am I going to... Now I don't longer look at it as that. The goal is just to never get into a position where opportunities are gone. If there's no opportunity for the next year and a half to write and direct a movie of my own creation, then that opportunity is not there right now. And I need to look for opportunities to do some writing or to get hired on a movie that's happening. And if those aren't there, then I need to find the other opportunity. But yeah, I mean, the goal, I'd like to make a movie that's the number one movie in the country someday.
That's a fine goal.
Yeah. That's the one I won't accomplish anytime soon, so I can hold on to that one for quite a while.
Are you okay with the fact that...
And Christopher Robin only ever made it to number two.
Was it number two?
Never made it to number one at the box office.
I'm really deeply
sorry. I did want to have my name on a movie that was number one at the box office, even just for a weekend, but didn't happen.
It can happen. Down the line. Someday. There's a lot of years. Are you okay with... It seems like you've acknowledged in your heart that no matter what you do, no matter how great something turns out, and really even if you do get a movie number one at the box office, which I think you're kind of joking about and you're kind of serious about.
Yeah, half and half.
Great.
It would feel cool.
It would, great. Are you okay with the fact that it won't make you too much happier?
Well, I know it won't. I'm not looking at it for that. I'm just looking at it because it's a fun goal. It's fun to, you know, see it, to create an insane goal and see if you can reach it. It's not that I'll be happy then, because I'm happy now. I mean, I'm not happy now because I'm in Los Angeles, but I'll be happy when I go home on Sunday. But that'll make me happy. No, it's not about goals for happiness. It's about goals for the sake of whatever that movie is. I mean, making that movie is the process.
What does make you happy?
Sitting at home and working. A day where my whole schedule is perfect. Everything's like I like. The phone's not ringing. The weather is not hot. And I can just sit at home and work and then cook dinner. That's the best. That's the best kind of day.
What was your perfect day when you were 12?
Well, probably a lot of Mortal Kombat.
In a way, I thought there's some connection there.
Maybe.
Inside, it's like a little
clap. Yeah, in both of these scenarios, I'm sitting inside by myself.
It's your default setting.
Seemingly.
Is that all right?
It works for me. It beats working.
Alex Ross Perry, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Finally, at least 2 years in the making.
All right.
It was right? Worth it. At least 2 years.
Yes. Yeah. Special thanks this week to Adam Kirsch, the Roosevelt Hotel, and Alex Ross Perry. His latest film, Her Smell, is out in theaters in New York April 12th. It will expand the next weekend on April 19th to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Austin, and Dallas-Fort Worth. A larger national rollout will follow in the weeks ahead. If you enjoyed today's conversation, I imagine you would enjoy other conversations we've had with directors like Sean Baker, James Gray, Rob Reiner, Chloe Zhao, Julie Dash, Jay Duplass, Joachim Trier, Alan Alda, Miguel Arteta, Janixa Bravo, Roger Ross Williams, Kelly Reichardt, Steve James. We've had a lot of directors on at this point. You can find all of those episodes and more at www.talkeasypod.com. Our entire back catalog is also available to stream for free on Spotify, SoundCloud, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And lastly, in case you missed it, we opened up a spot for you to donate to the show. This is a free, independently produced program, and you can donate to us on PayPal and Venmo at talkeasypod@gmail.com. To learn more about our show and how and where you can donate, be sure to visit our website at www.talkeasypod.com/donate. As always, the show is executive produced by David Chen, graphics by Ian Jones, illustrations by Krishna Shenoy, our social media is by Crystal Farmer, our booking is by Ian Chang, our intern is Elliot Weintraub, music by Dylan Peck, and the show this week is produced by Alyssa Greenberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you next week.
See new things. Try new things. Go back centuries while living in the moment. Forge new paths while discovering old ones. Pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. You know, I love music, but I haven't picked up an instrument in years. You know why? I tell myself, I don't have time. Where am I going to find a teacher? Well, there's an answer. Musora. Musora is the place where you can learn essential skills and techniques with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians and thousands of famous songs. You get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 per month, less than a single private lesson. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.